Well, welcome today. If you've been tracking with us, you know that we have been walking through the book of Ecclesiastes over the last number of months. And you will know that Solomon is a keen observer of human life. In fact, he is the kind of guy who tells it just like it is. There's no sugarcoating, no fluffing it up with sunshine and lollipops and kind of smoothing over it. He just tells life like it is. And as we come to the end or near the end of the book of Ecclesiastes, he makes a number of observations that all run along the same line, the same theme, and here it is. You might think that you have control over your life, but you don't. You know, we often live with the illusion that we do have control over our life, that we kind of have set the direction, that we're making it all happen. But Solomon looks at life and he says, actually, that's not the case. There's an illusion happening there. And he points it out in a number of different ways. Here's where he starts in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 7. He says this, since no one knows the future, who can tell someone else what is to come? As no one has the power over the wind to contain it, so no one has the power over the time of their death. You know, Solomon says this, can you tell the future? Do you control the wind? You don't have the kind of control over life that you think that you have. Did you know that, you don't know if a worldwide pandemic is going to come and completely change the plans of your life for 2 years. You don't know if there's a subprime mortgage bubble in the market that is about to burst and in a matter of weeks or months, people's entire life savings will be wiped out. You don't know if you're going to wake up tomorrow morning and feel a lump on your body that you hadn't realized was there and end up a few weeks from now with a cancer diagnosis. In fact, you don't even know if you're going to wake up tomorrow morning or if you will die in your sleep in the middle of the night. You see, we have this illusion that we have all this control over our life and we're going to go here and we're going to go that there and we're going to accomplish this. And Solomon says, don't be fooled. You have way less control over your life than you think you do. And it's not just you. I mean, no one has that kind of control. So Solomon goes on to write this. He says this, no one can comprehend what goes on under the sun. Despite all their efforts to search it out, no one can discover its meaning. Even if the wise claim they know, they cannot really comprehend it. You know, I read about a study that looked at all of the times over the past 50 years that the economists and the market watchers have predicted either a boom in the market or a bust in the market. And they looked at every single time, tons of times, I forget, hundreds of times, that they predicted either a boom or a bust. And what the study found was that they were right about 50% of the time, which means that they were also wrong about 50% of the times. In other words, they don't really know. And they're the smartest people out there when it comes to predicting what's going to happen in the market. And even as smart as they are, you still have as good a chance of knowing what is going to happen in the markets as if you flip a coin. You don't have as much control over your life as you think. Nobody does. And then Solomon goes on to say this, I've seen something else under the sun. The race is not to the swift or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise or wealth to the brilliant or favor to the learned. But time and chance happen to them all. When we read that, I think, oh, Solomon's been talking to my mom. Because, of course, I would come to my mom and say, my brother got this and I didn't. Or that guy is doing that and I'm not able to. And she would say to me, John, life is not fair. And that's exactly what Solomon is saying here. He says, life is not fair. Take, for instance, Bill Gates. Bill Gates, one of the most famous, most successful, most wealthy business people alive in the world today. But did you know that when Bill Gates went to school, he went to one of the few schools in the whole world that had a computer? It turns out that in his high school, there was a former World War II pilot who became a math and science teacher who looked and said, you know what? My students are going to need to know how to use computers when they get to university. And the year was 1968. So in 1968, his math and science teacher convinced the Parent Teacher Association, a bunch of moms who had run this huge rummage sale and raised $3,000, he convinced them to use that $3,000 to lease a Teletype Model 30 computer and have it hooked up to the General Electric mainframe. Now, you have to understand how incredible that was. That particular model, that particular computer had more computing power than most grad school, university grad schools had at that time. And Bill Gates and his buddy Paul Allen had access to that when they were only 13 years old in grade 8. In fact, that particular computer wasn't part of some sort of class. They didn't have computer class. It was extracurricular, which meant that Bill Gates and his buddy Paul Allen could spend all their time on that after school, late into the evenings, on the weekends, and that's exactly what they did. In fact, during one of those late evenings when Bill Gates and Paul Allen were playing on, you know, figuring out the computer and working on all of it, Bill Gates picked up a Forbes magazine with the cover of a CEO on it and asked his buddy Paul Allen, he said, "What do you think it'd be like to be like the CEO of a Fortune 500 company?" And Paul Allen said, "I have no idea." And Bill Gates said, "Maybe one day we'll get the chance to do that. We'll have our own computer company." And of course, today, Microsoft is worth over $1 trillion. But here's the interesting thing. In 1968, the UN counted that there were roughly 303 million high school age students around the globe. And of those 303 million, 18 million of them lived in the United States of America. And of those, 270,000 lived in the state of Washington. And of those, 100,000 lived in the city of Seattle. And of those, 300 went to Lakeside School, the school where Bill Gates and Paul Allen went, the school with the computer. So if you start with 300 million and end up with 300, that means that one in a million high school students attended a high school that had the combination of foresight and cash to be able to buy a major computer for their students to learn on. And Bill Gates happened to be one of those one in a million students. In fact, he acknowledges that if it hadn't been for that particular event in his life, if it hadn't been for that high school and the fact that he was there, that there would be no Microsoft today. It was an incredible opportunity. He had one in a million. But then let me tell you about Bill Gates' other friend, Kent Evans. Kent Evans was the third of the three computer prodigies, Bill Gates, Paul Allen, and Kent Evans. And Bill Gates would say that Kent Evans was not only equally as talented in the computer, he was not only that, he was one of the best students in the school, but unlike Paul Allen, he had the same kind of drive, the same kind of business mindset that Bill Gates had. And in grade 8, Bill Gates and Kent Evans became best friends. And they were always scheming together about what they would do. And they knew that whatever they would do in life, they were going to do it together. But Kent was killed in a mountaineering accident before he graduated from high school. And do you know that there are, in the United States every year, about 36 mountaineering accidents where people are killed in the U.S.? And the odds of being killed on a mountain in high school are roughly 1 in a million. So, two buddies. One guy becomes fabulously wealthy and rich and a world-changing businessman, and the other dies on the side of a mountain before he graduates from high school. See, this is what Solomon sees in life. For every Bill Gates, there's a Kent Evans. Time and chance happen to everyone. Life simply isn't fair. But maybe you're saying, I get it. But John, you're not accounting for God in the picture. I mean, if God is in the picture, that changes things, right? And maybe you're here and you're like, I'm sure I believe in God. But you would say, you know, for good people, it should be different, right? But that's not what Solomon observes either. Here's the next observation he makes. He says, there is something else meaningless that occurs on earth. The righteous who get what the wicked deserve and the wicked who get what the righteous deserve. This too, I say, is meaningless. Now, of course, in Ecclesiastes and all throughout the Bible, it's clear that there is great value in living in the wisdom and the fear of God. On the whole, your life should be richer and better because you're following God and He is in your life. But it isn't a guarantee that hard things and bad things won't happen in your life. Bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. Sometimes the good die young and the wicked live to a ripe old age. Sometimes the righteous are wiped out in a financial crisis and the wicked use the same crisis to line their pockets with more money. It happens more than you think. Again, here's the observation that Solomon is making. There are no guarantees in this life. And Solomon looks at all of this. And his conclusion is this. It's all meaningless. In other words, it's an enigma. It's a mystery. It's hard to grasp it all. It shouldn't be this way. It doesn't make sense this way. And yet, that's exactly the way that it is. And so he paints this pretty bleak and this pretty depressing picture. And yet, it's the truth. And so the question is, okay, Solomon, so what? Like, if we just fatalist and be like, well, I guess it is what it is. I mean, what's the answer here? And Solomon salts the answer a couple of times through this passage. Here's his answer. Back to Ecclesiastes that we just read. He says, there is something else meaningless that occurs on the earth. The righteous who get what the wicked deserve and the wicked who get what the righteous deserve. He says, this too, I say, is meaningless. But then right afterwards, immediately after, he says this. So I commend the enjoyment of life because there's nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and to be glad. Then joy will accompany them in their toil all the days of the life God has given them under the sun. And again in chapter 9, after pointing out the unfairness of life and the fact that there are no guarantees, he comes to this. He says this, go. Eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. Always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife whom you love all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun. All your meaningless days. For this is your lot in life and in your toilsome labor under the sun. So this is what Solomon says you should do in light of all of these things. You should put some gel in your hair. You should put on your going out clothes. You should get all dressed up. You should go out and eat and drink. Then you should come home and have great sex with your spouse. I mean, and you should be glad and enjoy your life. That's what he says is the answer to all the unfairness and the fact that there's no guarantees in life and that you don't have that much control over it. In fact, Solomon doesn't just say it twice in this passage we're looking at. If you read the book of Ecclesiastes from beginning to end about six times, usually at the bleakest moments of his monologue, this is what he says. In fact, a number of times he calls this the gift of God. Here's what Solomon is saying. We may not have much control over what happens in our life. It may not always be fair. There are no guarantees. But the gift of God in this life to you and I is that we should enjoy the simple good things in life, like friendship and family and a good meal and a sunny day. Now, you can't control those things either. They certainly aren't guaranteed to each of us, but they're God's gift to you because they bring beauty and joy into your life. But here's the catch. They bring beauty and joy into your life if you don't miss them, if you're paying attention to them. See, it's a point that Solomon has made a number of times already in Ecclesiastes, but it is a point that he believes is so valuable and so important and so overlooked that he makes it two more times here at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes. And that's this. We tend to take life under the sun both too seriously and not seriously enough. We're way too serious about the things that we can't control, the things that we ultimately can't make happen in our life. We're so serious about those things, and we're not nearly serious enough about the ordinary things in our life, the family and the friends and the good things in our life that make it so rich and so beautiful and so sweet. And in this passage, at the end of this, or near the end of Ecclesiastes, Solomon says that life is filled with both hardship and sweetness, bitterness and beauty, and they come at the same time. You see, we think that it's an either or thing. We think that either life is bad and it's out of control and painful and we can't make sense of it, or that it's all good, or at least it should be all good. And we have this starry-eyed optimism that God is or should be in the process of making, you know, our life so that everything is finally good, so we float through it with joy and happiness on every side. But life doesn't work that way. And if you have that kind of expectation that somewhere your life is just going to get all good all the time, you are going to be deeply disappointed. You know, when I was 6 or 7 years old, the greatest movie ever made came out, Star Wars. But because I was so young, my folks didn't let me go to see the Star Wars movie. And so I spent my whole life growing up listening to my friends tell me about the most amazing movie they'd ever seen in Star Wars this and Star Wars that. And of course, back in the 70s, there was no, you know, there was no video store, there was no VCR, there was no streaming Netflix service. So once it was out of the theater, you couldn't see it anymore. So for 20 years, I didn't get a chance to see this until in my mid-20s, a couple of friends invited me over and said, we're going to watch all three Star Wars movies in one night. And I was so excited. I was finally going to get a chance to see Star Wars. And after 3 or 4 or 5 hours, I can't remember how long it was, I came to the firm conclusion that Star Wars is a B-rate movie with weak acting and a poor plot line, right? Right? I mean, we know this, right? Now, before you stone me, some of you anyway, you have to remember that my problem was that I'd had these high expectations that were through the roof. Even if it was the greatest movie ever made, and we all know that it wasn't, but even if it was, because my expectations had built so high, I still would have felt the same way. And those of you who are still, you know, shaking your head thinking, how could he say that? You know that when the prequels came out in the early 2000s, it happened to you, right? Everyone was like, oh, the prequels. And they're like, oh, they weren't that good. Expectations were too high. In this section of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is pretty brutal in pointing out what life is really like. And it's his gift to you and to me. Because if you expect that somehow following God means that your life is going to become all rainbows and butterflies and unicorns, that he owes you an easy and a wonderful life because out of the goodness of your heart, because you were so kind and gracious, you agreed to allow God to call you his son or daughter, you're going to be very disappointed. And if you're not careful, you're going to turn on God and resent him for not doing what he never promised that he would do. See, here's what Solomon wants you to grasp. When it comes to the good and bad, the joy and the sorrow, life isn't either or, it's both and. Rick Warren, the pastor of a large, fairly influential church in California, said this in an interview a number of years ago. He said, this past year has been the greatest year of my life, but also the toughest with my wife, Kay, getting cancer. I used to think that life was hills and valleys. You go through a dark time, then you go to the mountaintop, back and forth. I don't believe that anymore. Rather than life being hills and valleys, I believe that it's a kind of like two rails on a railroad track. And at all times, you have something good and something bad in your life. No matter how good things are in your life, there's always something bad that needs to be worked on. And no matter how bad things are in your life, there's always something good that you can thank God for. It's interesting. He gave this interview on the year when his book sold millions of copies. I mean, it was a wildly successful year. And in that very same year, at the same time that he was celebrating that success, his wife, Kay, had a very serious case of cancer. Two rails on a railroad track. Best year of his life was also the worst year. Goodness and hardship, beauty and pain, they happen at the same time. It's just how life goes. And what Solomon wants us to understand is that life's disappointments, the sorrows, the pain that we experience along the way, They aren't just obstacles to joy in our life. Instead, they are a key part to embracing a life of true joy and happiness. The pain helps us appreciate the beauty and to experience the joy. You know, on my Instagram account, this clip popped up of these guys riding their mountain bikes. It was incredible what they would do. I mean, they're on the edge of a cliff, and they just launch over the cliff, and they just sail down these mountains, and then they rip along at fantastic speeds through these narrow trails, and then they hit these huge jumps. And I mean, they just fly through the air, and sometimes they flip, and they come. I mean, it's unbelievable to watch. And so I started following this guy and these clips of these amazing, amazing rides. But then they began to be interspersed with these clips of huge fails, catastrophic fails. The same guys that were racing, you know, were launching off cliffs, were falling off cliffs. And the ones that were like whipping around corners missed the corner and flipped over their bike. And it's a huge garage sale. And these guys who went to do these jumps, these big jumps, they miscalculated and either they fell short or they went too far. But either way, you can barely tear your eyes away from it. And you know this too. I mean, if you've watched People Are Amazing or Fail Army, you know the same feeling. Why is it that when we watch that bike crash, we can't look away? Well, two reasons, I think. One, because we're just so glad that it isn't us, right? But secondly, on a deeper level, it points out that there are no guarantees to life. That even for those who seem to have it all together, there's a curve that comes in the path that they weren't expecting, a tree that where they thought there wasn't going to be a tree, a jump that was further than they thought. And the same is true for us. You know, tragedy strikes from out of the blue, or our plans fall apart, our career path falters, a relationship sours, money disappears, our health takes a turn for the worse. And we experience all kinds of pain and disappointment and failure. And sometimes we rage against how unfair it all is. And we think it's the worst thing that could happen in our life. But you see, what Solomon is getting at is that those very disappointments and failures in your life, if you allow them to, can become the key to experiencing joy and beauty in your life. And here's how. If you're willing to accept it, and many are never willing to accept it, but if you are willing to accept it, the failures of your life will strip you of the illusion that you are in control of your life and that you can make things happen the way you want to. And that's a gift to you. Because if you spend your whole life trying to control the things that you simply can't control, no matter how special you think you are, how gifted you believe you are, you will spend your whole life frustrated and angry and filled with anxiety and despair, and you will miss. You'll be utterly blind to the goodness and beauty that is to be found in the good things right around you. It happens to people all of the time. They're so consumed with what they can't control that they miss what's right before them. I mean, it happens with, you know, people who are building a business and they want it to be the best, the biggest, the most successful business ever. But you know, that's something that's ultimately out of their control. They can't make that happen. But if they're so focused on that, then they begin to miss the amazing people that are working on their staff. They begin to miss the opportunities to do something really cool for a client, to go above and beyond and just really bless them because they're able to bring joy into their life. They miss all the good things that their business at whatever size it is already accomplishing. And the very thing that should bring them joy into their life sucks the life out of them because they're trying to control what they can't control and missing the beauty that's right in front of them. It's not just businesses. I mean, it's families. You see it in families all the time. People want their families to be the perfect family. All the kids, you know, hair done nice, all in a row. Everyone planning to go to college and become either a CEO or a lawyer or a professional athlete. You know, it's not bad. In fact, you should teach your children to behave. And you should invite them, press them to be all that they, you know, all they can be. But if you're trying to control them, if you're trying to force them into your plans, if you're trying to make your family become something that ultimately you have no control over because your children are their own people ultimately, then you will find yourself frustrated and filled with disappointment and anxiety, and you will miss the beauty and the joy of who your kids are and what God is doing in them in the midst of the kind of messiness of life. Same problem happens to those who are so intent on making money that they grind away day and night. And they miss the moments with their friends because they're working so hard. And as we talked about in the past, money is notoriously unstable, and they build their whole life. They spend their whole life accumulating this pile of money that may or may not disappear overnight. But they miss all the little moments and the big moments along the way that would bring beauty and laughter into their life. Solomon says that some of the failures in your life, if they strip you of the illusion of control so that you can begin to see the goodness that God has surrounded with you with, they can become some of the greatest kindnesses in your life. See, there are all kinds of things that you simply can't control. And the sooner you acknowledge your powerlessness, that you're not able to control them, the sooner you can put your hands, your life in the hands of a sovereign God who is in control. Not only in control of your life, but in control of everything in the universe. And then you can rest in the fact that he is good and loving, and that he has promised that he will work all things together for the good of those who love him and who are called according to his purposes. And then you enter into a different place, don't you? A place that allows you to enjoy the simple and the beautiful things in life. In fact, it's often the juxtaposition of the goodness and the beauty of your life, of those simple things against the hardship and the pain and the sorrow of your life that intensifies their beauty and their goodness and make them that much more joyful. This is the gift of God. There are three outcomes. The result, if you accept this gift from God. First of all, it's what we've already been talking about. If you acknowledge your powerlessness, and trust in the sovereignty of God, you find joy in your life. See, when you come to adopt a posture of total trust in God, it will free you up to enjoy life as you actually experience it, not as you think it ought to be. It's a beautiful result. But then here's the second one. If you trust in the sovereignty of God, you can experience freedom. You know, the older you get, the more life you live, the more you know that you can have the most noble of intentions, the best laid plans, the finest goals, and yet life is never going to turn out exactly the way that you planned it. Doesn't mean it's going to be horrible. It just means it never turns out exactly the way that you think it will go. But if you're always occupied with the past, with what didn't work, and I wish that it had been different. I mean, if you're always occupied thinking about the failures and the disappointments in your life, or if you spend your whole life preoccupied with trying to control the future and trying to make it go the way that you want it to go, then you never live in the present. Then you never have the opportunity to just enjoy what God has given you right here and right now. But if you trust in a sovereign God, man, that allows a freedom in your life to just relax and to be present in the moment. It's the second part of the gift from God. You experience freedom. Which leads to the last thing that Solomon talks about in this section. In the beginning of chapter 11, this is what he says. Ship your grain across the sea. After many days, you may receive a return. Invest in 7 ventures, yes, in 8. You do not know what disaster may come upon the land. If clouds are, whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the path of the wind or how the body is formed in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. Sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let your hands not be idle. For you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. Solomon says this, ship your grain across the ocean, and you might receive a return. but you might not. I mean, you have to understand that in that day, sailing on the ocean was a dangerous thing. The ships were small and not as well built, and they had no radar to tell when storms were coming. And if you shipped your entire grain across the ocean, you might get a huge payday back. And on the other hand, your ship might sink and you lose everything. He says, you should do that. He says, you should invest. Invest in 7 or 8 different things. Some are going to work out and some aren't. Some will be a winner and many will be failures. He says, if you're a farmer, you should plant your crops, even if you don't know what the weather's going to be like. Here's what he's saying. You should be bold. You should be bold. Because now you're grounded. Now you have realistic expectations about life. Now you understand the good and the bad, that they run on parallel tracks. If your ship comes in, you get this great payday. But if your ship sinks, you will lose all your grain and you'll be disappointed for sure. But you won't be devastated. You won't shake your fist at God as if somehow he owed you all that money. If your investments come through, you rejoice. You say, thank God. It's so good. But if it doesn't, you won't beat yourself up as a loser because you made such terrible investment decisions and give up on ever investing again. Instead, you will acknowledge that not everything is in your control. And instead, that you are trusting in the sovereign hand of God. If you plant your crops and the rains come and the sun shines and the crops produce a bumper harvest, you will gather your friends together and your family together and they'll sit around the table and eat and laugh and feast and celebrate God's goodness in your life and be filled with all kinds of joy. But if you plant your crops and the sun comes and the rain comes and your crops grow, but then a freak hailstorm comes and wipes out your crops completely, so that you have nothing but misses your neighbor's field and your neighbor is a corrupt and an evil man and he gets a bumper crop and goes off. You know what you do? You gather your friends and your family around your table and you eat and you drink. And as you look around that table, you look at the goodness and the beauty and the kindness of God in your life and you celebrate. And you laugh and you joy and you trust in the sovereign hand of a good and loving God that is caring for you no matter what happens in your life. See, this is the gift of God. This is one of the many reasons why you need God in your life. Because he pours his gifts out on us who trust after him. So would you bow your heads with me? Let me pray for you. Well, our God, Heavenly Father, we thank you again for your word, which is just so, so honest, so true, that just calls it like it is, but that doesn't leave us in some kind of bleak, desolate, lost place, but then points us to life and hope through God, through what you have done in our life. And so, God, on this day, I pray for each of us. Father, as we look at our life, it's like the railroad track. There's such good things in our life. And there's some really hard things in our life at the same time. And Father, forgive us when we have thought that somehow it should be totally different. Help us, Lord, in the midst of the hard things to see the beauty, to see the grace, to see the joy, to rest in your sovereignty, to know your grace and your goodness, and to find happiness and beauty because of who you are, because of what you've done in our life. Thank you, God, for the gift that you have given us. We bless you and we praise you in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, thank you for coming and joining us again today as we sit under God's word and allow it to shape us and to form us into the kind of people that he calls us to be. I want to send you out with these words from the Apostle Paul. He writes to the church in Romans and to us, he says this, and we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purposes. May God bless you. As you go from this place today, may you walk in the goodness and the grace and the knowledge of a sovereign God who is at work in your life and who is working all things according to his plans and purposes for our good because of our love for him. God bless you. Have a great Sunday. We'll see you next week.